and having that real laser focus on that, this is the most important thing for me to do today, allows me to make sure that I make time for that. And then at the end of the day, I did that thing. I can feel good about my day, no matter how many other little things I checked off my to-do list.
This is Task Time Energy, the Purpose-Filled Productivity Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Miller. Welcome to the show. Welcome, everyone. Our guest today is Graham Downey. Graham is a graduate of Yale Law School. He scored a 180 on the law school admission test, the LSAT, which is a perfect score. Graham has his own LSAT website, Lightweight LSAT, which is a free online guide that helps people prepare for the test. He also works as a consumer advocate with a nonprofit organization in Alaska. And it's awesome to have you here, Graham.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me, Scott. Really excited to be here.
Anything else you want to add to your bio? Let people know.
Oh, I think the one important thing to know about the Lightweight LSAT is that it's a work in progress. So folks are invited to go check it out and let me know what they think about it too. So yeah, it's completely free and takes you kind of from the basics up to some of the more advanced moves that you might need. And it's a work in progress. So jump in and contribute.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's really cool to give people that resource to get your take on the test as somebody who is definitely an expert. And you and I met when we were working together for a test preparation company a number of years ago.
That's right. You were my trainer. In fact, I probably wouldn't have scored a perfect score on the LSAT if I hadn't had training from Scott Miller.
Yeah, that was fun. That was super fun being your trainer. And then we worked together on a few other projects, which were definitely fun. So we are here today to talk about timing on the LSAT. And, you know, we were talking about this a little bit before we started recording, but I think, and I'm definitely interested in hearing what you think, Graham, I think there are a lot of interesting lessons that the LSAT can teach people about time management, both maybe, you know, the test itself and also, you know, the process of preparing for the test. And I think maybe some people who are listening probably won't know exactly what the law school admission test is, what the LSAT is. How would you describe it? If you had like a couple minutes to describe the LSAT to somebody, how would you describe it, Graham?
Oh, geez. Wow. That's a great question. The LSAT is a hazing ritual designed to keep people out of law school. and it tests a pretty specific set of skills, which is your ability to, I think in general, like pedantically follow either sentences or rules kind of one by one, at the same time as you have to creatively extract meaning and make connections and see what connections aren't there. So it's this really challenging connection of both like very mathy, very logical analysis of arguments, or in the game section, they give you, you know, A can't be next to B, but it has to be next to C, you're kind of following rules like that. And then at the same time as you're doing that pedantic mathy thing, you also have to get creative and notice that, oh, well, if A can't be next to B and A has to be next to C, then C can't be next to B or something like that. I mean, actually, that's not a good inference, but you see the point. I think there's this really challenging combination of logic and creativity there on the LSAT.
Yeah, that's a great explanation. I think great description, especially the connection between logic and creativity. You know, it's, well, it's was 100 scored questions. Now it's 75 scored questions. And they're testing very, like you said, very specific skills. What I often tell people is it's testing advanced reading comprehension skills. So your ability to read very carefully, very literally, you know, understand like the literal meaning of words and notice important details. And then it's testing analytical reasoning skills, critical thinking skills, your ability to think logically and understand connections between ideas. And the one of the things that's really tough about the LSAT is the timing requirement, the time pressure that they put on you. You know, you'll have maybe like a minute to answer a question. You know, if you want to try to answer all the questions and get as high of a score as possible, you're looking at answering a lot of these questions in like a minute or less. And they're really complicated questions to answer in that short period of time. A lot of people just struggle with that aspect of it. You know, I mean, Graham, you tell me, how many times have you heard somebody say, oh, I can answer all the questions, I just always run out of time. There's no way I can answer all these questions in that amount of time.
I would say like maybe 80, 90% of students feel that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like that, at least at first, you know, if you stick with it and you're willing to learn, you know, about the test and how it works, then people get to that point. And I'm curious, you know, I'd say you're probably somebody who's qualified to talk about this, you know, seeing as you graduated from Yale Law School, which is often ranked as the top law school in the country. You have a perfect score on the LSAT. How relevant do you think the LSAT is to, like, how well does it test skills that people actually need for law school?
That's a great question. Yeah, I was perhaps being a little unfair when I called it a hazing ritual. I think the real hazing ritual is actually the bar after law school. But anyway, that's a discussion for another time. Yeah, I think the LSAT is actually surprisingly relevant. I think legal thinking requires a really careful application of facts to law, right? And legal thinking is mostly thinking by analogy, right? You have a series of facts. Are those facts close to the facts of a case that you're reading? You know, the judge has ruled about, you know, an accident that happened on a railroad. Is that analogous to this accident that happened on a car road? And you have to be able to really precisely follow the rules and complicated reasoning of a case and apply that to the novel facts in front of you. So in that sense, I think a lot of those logical reasoning and reading comprehension skills and logic game skills are really relevant to law school, that methodical, careful, not jumping to any conclusions type thinking.
Yeah. And it seems like, you know, maybe like, again, you know this better than me, but when you're reading statutes or you're reading contracts, the ability to read very literally and say, not what do I think this means, but what does it actually say on the page?
That's right. Yeah. I think folks think that lawyers are advocates and they confuse advocacy with hopeful thinking. You know, I want it to be this way. I think the law should be this way. And that's actually something that is a fun thing to get to think about in law school. And as an advocate now, it's nice to think that way. But to be a good lawyer and actually to be a really good advocate, you have to read what's on the page. You have to see what's actually there, not what you hope or wish was there for your client. Because otherwise you're going to do your client a disservice if you go into the court and say, well, it should be the case that my client shouldn't go to jail. The judge is going to be like, well, what does the law say? Yeah. So if you want to protect your clients, then you have to read what's in front of you.
Yeah.
The other thing I guess I should say is that one of the challenges of the LSAT is that it includes a lot of intentionally bad writing. Mm-hmm. And lawyers, again, I'm being really harsh on the legal profession right now, but lawyers and judges are not always the best writers. Although actually, to be fair, law school is a place where you can learn to become a much better writer. Again, that clarity of thought, that methodical thinking. But on the other hand, a lot of bad writing. And so being able to navigate complex sentences full of pronouns and unclear objects and verbs or lacking verbs, like that's a really important thing that you learn when you're studying for the LSAT that is relevant for all of life, but particularly reading legal writing.
So we were talking earlier about lessons in time management. And I told you I have my own ideas about this, but I'm curious to, you know, just even off the top of your head, what do you think are some lessons that people can learn from the LSAT about managing time? And I'll just keep that very general. What are some lessons that people can learn that would apply to everyday life or our work?
Yeah, I mean, the LSAT is such a crucible in the sense, like it is, timing is what the test is testing, your ability to think really quickly. I think Three things jump out to me that I've learned or that I use from the LSAT in everyday life or in terms of thinking about everyday life. One is about sticking to my intentions. So I think this is more about how you study for the test, but when you're studying for the LSAT, I think the temptation is to go full speed all of the time. Right? You're trying to simulate test conditions all of the time. You see this a lot on like Reddit advice about how to study for the LSAT. It's like, just do a bunch of full-time practice tests and then somehow magically repetition will turn into skill. I think that's a really common misconception in society. So for anyone trying to learn anything, I think it's just not true. Yes, you need a certain amount of repetition to be able to spot the patterns, which will ultimately help you get faster, but you have to vary your approach based on what your intention is. If your intention is to figure out what are actually these underlying patterns underneath the LSAT, that I can spot more quickly in the future. If your goal is to find those patterns and discover those patterns, more of that exploratory mode, you have to go slower. You know, you have to slow down when you're reading the question. You have to really dig into it. You have to be wrong a bunch about what it's actually saying and test out different theories about what's going on in that little tiny argument, that three sentence argument on the LSAT. You have to really dig into it. Or that game with, you know, five rules, instead of trying to get them down as quickly as possible and start, you know, playing the game, you sit with those rules and you figure out, how are these working together? What's really the most important thing here? Like, what did I assume was true? What is actually true? And really sitting with it and having this like sort of exploratory practice with it, you have to slow down. You have to vary your pace as you're studying. I think that's a really just lovely lesson for life in general, is that, you know, remember why you're here. Are you here to get through this thing as fast as you possibly can? Or are you here to like learn and absorb and appreciate what's going on and really dig into this moment? And I think assuming that we have to do everything as fast as we possibly can, you know, I think is something that a lot of us feel in everyday life. Yeah, one lesson from the LSAT for me. I don't know if you have reactions to that, Scott.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Everything you're saying applies to both studying for the LSAT and during the test itself while you're actually taking the test. Because there are times when you're going to want to sit down and do actual practice under the actual timed test conditions that you're going to see on test day. But there are also times where, you know, I tell my students, you got to, you know, put on some soft music and put your feet up and pour yourself a cup of tea and really dig in. Like you said, slow down and really analyze these questions and, you know, think about your understanding of the question and what are you understanding and what is still confusing for you? And how do you, if you chose a wrong answer, well, why did you choose that answer? Why did that look right to you? And why is the correct answer correct? And why didn't it look correct? So, yeah. And then on the test itself, it's not about going as fast as you can the whole time. It's about knowing when you can go fast. And, you know, if you're answering a question and it's a type of question that you tend to be really good at, you always get these right. It looks to you like a pretty straightforward question and you're confident just running right through it in, you know, 40 seconds. Yeah, step on the gas for sure. But then when you get to this really confusing, convoluted answer choice that is intentionally written in the most confusing way possible, slow down. Like that is, as soon as you say, wow, this is confusing, that's like a red light coming on or yellow light maybe telling you slow down, read more carefully, let your brain absorb this information. That's a big challenge for people because there is, because of the strict time pressure, people just feel tempted to go as fast as they can all the time on the test. And that's why people make mistakes.
Yeah. And I think the other, maybe there's a life lesson to be gleaned out of this too. But one thing I used to tell students is to trust their confusion, right? Like if you're confused, trust that, you know, slow down. That's such a good sign. If you look at all five of the answers on the LSAT and you're like, I don't know what's going on here. None of these seem right. That tells you that you missed something, right? Because the LSAT is actually one of its virtues is that it's perfect. There is always one correct answer. So I think one thing that's really nice is trusting your confusion in order to be like, well, hold on. It takes almost a humility to trust your confusion, right? To be like, okay, I need to slow down here. I don't care if this is question number one, it's supposed to be the easiest question on the test, or question number, you know, 17, the hardest question on the test or whatever. I'm going to slow down because I'm confused here, and really trusting yourself in that way, which is hard, really hard to balance with that confidence when you're feeling good. Because I think one thing students learn on the LSAT is they do those really hard questions and they get totally bamboozled. And then they take that bamboozlement and they apply it to everything. They assume, you know, it's almost like you know, it's almost like a trauma. You're like looking around every corner for your think every question's gonna be confusing and difficult because you're not sensitive to your own internal perception of difficulty. You won't if you don't trust yourself to slow down when it's hard, then you won't trust yourself to speed up when it's easy. So I think there's that, trusting yourself has two sides to the coin there.
Yeah, that's a great, I love, you know, trusting your confusion and using that as information, because often when we feel confused, especially when you're in the middle of an important test, your brain automatically interprets that as a bad thing. Like, oh, this is bad. I should not be confused. Instead of saying, Well, okay, I'm confused. Now that's useful information because, you know, that why am I confused? Oh, that means slow down a little bit. Maybe I just need to read more carefully. And again, in life too, you know, great life lessons, like some of these feelings, confusion, sadness, whatever it is, we interpret them as bad and like, oh, I shouldn't be experiencing this. And just instead of just saying either A, this is normal, like this is just something that happens, or even this is information. This is something I can learn from.
Yeah, I heard someone say the other day that you should use bad days as good information. I think that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. Turning judgment into information is how we grow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you said something, you know, also in terms of life lessons, kind of paying attention in life to when we're going fast and when we're going slow and why. Like, is this just something, some activity that I just want to race through and get and be done with? Or is this something that I want to slow down and enjoy, you know, and is that more valuable than just getting it done? That can be hard for people who are, you know, have a lot going on in life and have a lot of responsibilities, but it's a good lesson.
Yeah. Yeah. This is something I notice a lot in the advocacy world and sort of the nonprofit advocacy world is there's so many constant emergencies going on in the world. You know, there's so many urgent things. If you watch whatever John Oliver's show, every single night there's a new horrible thing you learn about the world, which is a reason that I don't watch those sorts of things. And I find that there's so much pressure to do everything all the time. And the most effective advocates that I know and what I've been trying to do for myself are people who pick one thing to do, maybe two things to do, and they focus laser on that one thing rather than trying to do everything all at once.
I can see that. And especially, you know, in some of my past experiences working in the nonprofit world, I mean, again, it applies to so many areas of life, making that decision of, do I want to slow down and take my time and focus on this one thing and do it as well as possible? Or do I just need to knock this out quickly so I can get to as many things as possible? And I mean, there's no, you know, I'm a big fan of slowing down and taking my time and doing things and, you know, savoring the experience. But you know, again, sometimes when coaching people, I'll tell them so maybe the best thing to do, or at least something to try, is set time limits, set really strict time limits for yourself. If you like to write or, you know, any kind of creative work, you can really get into a bit of a rabbit hole where you spend all day doing something that maybe could only take an hour. And sometimes you just have to say, I'm going to set a limit and I'm only going to spend an hour doing this. And that's those kind of boundaries, I think, can really ultimately end up being satisfying if it's a choice, right?
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think that's a nice segue to one of the other lessons I think I've learned from the LSAT in terms of timing, kind of the converse of the trusting yourself, knowing when to slow down is the how to speed up. The connection here is that know what your intention is going into the activity, right? Are you trying to have an exploratory, slow, appreciate the moment, or are you trying to really practice speed, really get through this as quickly as possible, and have that intention somewhere recorded, written down, you know, either turn the timer off or have it be like a count up timer so you can get information about timing, or have that countdown timer, really, I'm focused on racing here. I'm not going to get distracted by that one really hard question because I'm trying to go really hard here. Yeah. So anyway, just being clear about that intention and sticking to that intention so you can be really kind to yourself and like, well, yeah, I was supposed to spend all morning writing my essay, or no, I was only supposed to spend half an hour writing today. That was my goal and I achieved that. So now I can put this away and feel really good about what I did and I can move on. Yeah. Or I got a little rambly there, but I think anyway, I'll get to the point, which is I think one thing that is required for success on the LSAT is to do some resistance training when it comes to time. So I think for me, what this looks like is making things harder than they'll actually be on test day and being really ambitious, like beyond ambitious. I'm going beyond my limits, going beyond my capacity and intentionally trying to stretch and grow beyond where I'm comfortable by picking a really ridiculous goal and really trying to stretch and reach towards that goal, even though I'm pretty confident I'm going to fail. So I think in the LSAT example, or in the LSAT context, this might look like, you know, logic games, you have four of them to do in 35 minutes. So you have an average of 8.5 minutes per game. But the games are, as you mentioned, such different difficulty that you need to spend really different times on each game. So aiming for that 8:30 on every game means you're going to get hosed on the really difficult one because you're not going to get it done in 8:30.
I want to add a quick note here for the benefit of anyone who isn't totally familiar with the LSAT. You may be wondering what these games are that we're talking about. So these logic games are basically like logic puzzles, and you find these in one of the sections on the LSAT. So they'll basically give you some type of scenario, they'll describe some type of situation, and then give you a set of rules that apply to that situation. And then they'll ask somewhere from like 5 to 7 questions based on those rules. And some of the questions are testing your ability to apply the rules directly, but a lot of the questions are testing your understanding of the implications of the rules, what inferences you can draw from the rules. And these logic games and these questions can be kind of challenging for a lot of people, especially when they first start practicing for the test, because these are very different from anything a lot of people have experienced in the past. And you'll have 4 of these games to complete in 35 minutes. So on average, you have about 8 minutes and 30 seconds or 8 minutes and 45 seconds to complete one of these games. All right, let's get back to what Graham was saying.
So what I like to tell students to do is try to finish a game in 4 minutes, right? Half of the time that you're kind of expecting to finish it in. And everyone's like, nope, can't do it, impossible. And you know, no human can finish a logic game in 4 minutes. Maybe ChatGPT could, but I can't. I'm not going to finish a logic game in 4 minutes. And then I'm like, well, try. You know you're going to fail. You can let go of a lot of judgment about being perfect. You can let go of a lot of judgment about, and you can baseline yourself, right? You can be like, well, I was aiming for 8 minutes. Now, if I aim for 4 minutes, maybe 6 minutes will feel slow, you know, but now you've gained 2.5 minutes over where you were before.
Right.
So you can kind of have that really aggressive, I call it like sprinting practice, where you're going for that really aggressive goal in order to change your sense of what's normal, to really grow beyond where you're comfortable and just sort of like move past maybe a plateau or a limit that you'd set for yourself that you'd gotten really used to. I wonder what those 8-minute logic games look like in the rest of our life. I think that's a...
Yeah, well, there's a really good lesson in there, I think, about clinging to perfection. Because this is what I notice sometimes when I'm talking to students about how they're preparing for the test is people are afraid to like make mistakes. When you're taking a practice test, people are very focused on the score and how I really want to get a good score on this practice test, rather than saying, hey, this is an experiment. This is practice. And I might make mistakes and I might totally mess this up, but I'm going to learn something by doing that. If I sit down and, you know, it normal average time to finish a logic game is like you said, 8.5 minutes. And if I try to do it in 4 minutes, I might totally muck that up completely, but it's worth trying. And then maybe I'll try it 3 more times. So I think it's an example of where, and again, so many examples of this in everyday life, but that clinging to the idea that we have to be perfect all the time just limits our opportunities, you know, and it depends on where someone's at. You know, if you're just starting out studying for the test, you just first heard of the LSAT 2 weeks ago, and now you're just sitting down to study, maybe you don't want to push yourself so hard. Maybe you want to, you know, be kind to yourself, and it's a lot of information, a lot of new information. But then, yeah, once you're into it, you want to start challenging yourself in that way. I often, you know, I make comparisons to sports, like, you know, in windsurfing. It's one of my passions in life is windsurfing. And you know, you don't really know how fast you can go until you wipe out. If you're always holding back and, you know, afraid to go smack into the water face first, you're never going to know how fast you can go. And I tell students that, especially when you're aiming for a top score, you know, if you're pushing into the 170s, you have to find out how fast you can go, even if it means messing up and making mistakes.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. My inspiration also comes from sports here in terms of weightlifting. If you go to the gym and you bench press, you know, whatever, the same weight every single time you go to the gym, you're not going to get any stronger, right? Like your body adapts to difficulty. That's how weight training works, is you try to lift a heavier weight every time you go, or, you know, as you get more advanced, you actually can't grow as much each time. So you have to reduce the amount. Sometimes you'll go back and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, but the point is our body grows by adapting to stress, right? We increase the stress, our body, our brains adapt to that stress, and then we can increase the stress from there. So it's that cycle, the growth is that cycle of stress, rest, where we push our bodies past, or our brains past where we think we're capable. Then we rest and recover. Then we do it again.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, looking at the overall, again, going like macro and micro here, you know, often I'll tell students, and this is something I do myself now, you know, if I'm going to sit down and take a practice test or do a practice section, I always force myself to go a little slowly on the first question. Or if it's a reading comprehension passage, you know, the first paragraph, especially the very first one of the section, slow down, because it's so easy to, you know, just jump in and try to go full speed right away. And then I read a whole paragraph and go, what did I just read? I have no idea what I just read. I was going full speed. So I think with you know, even starting out your prep, when you first start preparing for the LSAT, it's okay to, you know, get acclimated, right? It's going to maybe feel like a lot of information. It's going to feel a little overwhelming. So that's okay. Take it step by step. Take it slow. But then, yeah, once you get used to things and you're really starting to, you know, try to increase your score, be willing to challenge yourself. Be willing to push yourself. It's not always about doing it perfectly. It's about trying things that you may not want to do on test day, but they're good drills, they're good exercises, or they're just finding out how fast you can go if you need to go. How sloppy can you be? These are all good things to know.
Yeah. Sometimes it's good to know what can you get away with, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think about this sometimes at work with email, you know, like my temptation is to write a perfect email every single time. And, you know, there is a certain amount of professionalism in like dotting my T's and crossing my I's and having proper punctuation in an email. But there's also a lot of virtue in just replying to that email right away. You know, there's actually sometimes more kindness to my colleague if I'm replying faster rather than replying perfectly. So, yeah, kind of learning what you can get away with when it does and doesn't matter is an important skill in life.
Yeah. Well, like you were talking about, you know, challenging yourself to finish that logic game in 4 minutes. Well, what happens if you have a whole game to complete and you only have 4 minutes left? It's a very different to be in that situation and feel really panicked about it as opposed to saying, okay, well, not ideal, but I've practiced this. I've done this a bunch of times. I'm going to do the best I can.
Mm. And that is something that I saw so often in ambitious LSAT students is that they planned for perfection,
mm-hmm.
right? They wanted to be perfect. They had such high expectations for themselves that they were like, well, here's how it's going to happen on test day. And they wanted that thought to become reality, right? They almost wanted, maybe whether or not they believed in manifestation, they were acting as if they believed in manifestation, right? And I think there is virtue in that. You know, I think I've heard Shaq talk about visualizing the ball going in the bucket and, you know, there is virtue in that. But there's also you make yourself so fragile when you plan for perfection, when you're like, okay, it has to go exactly this way on test day for things to be okay, especially, you know, on the LSAT, they had this transition to digital and to the take-home test during COVID. And there were so many disruptions and there were so many proctors who didn't actually know what the rules were. And I had so many students coming in tears to me after test day because the LSAT had messed up their experience in some little way. And because they'd been planning for perfection, they weren't resilient. They weren't able to adapt to those disruptions.
Absolutely. I'm looking up something right now, something that you recommended that I've been looking at and really enjoying. It's Oliver Berkman and his Imperfectionist newsletter.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm a big fan.
And it's all about that, right? It's all about acknowledging, like, yeah, you can totally aim for greatness and you can visualize that perfect shot. If you're a basketball player, you can visualize yourself doing the LSAT perfectly. And yet realistically, you want to ask yourself, well, what happens if it all goes sideways, right? Like, am I really prepared for a situation where things go wrong? And am I ready to just deal with it?
Right.
Because life is not perfect.
Yeah. And that's something I think on the LSAT, I don't wonder how this translates to life, but the LSAT is a curved test, which means that you're competing against everyone else that you're taking the test. And so I think students are afraid, for example, of like their weak section being a really difficult section, right? I hear students be like, well, I really hope it's an easy reading section, or I hope it's an easy game section. And I tell them, no, hope for the opposite. You are, thanks to my amazing teaching, you are better than the average person at encountering difficulty. And you want the section actually to be more difficult because that's going to give you an opportunity to do what you need to do to step past those people who are planning on perfection, who don't actually have robust systems for dealing with difficult games, who don't have the ability to, like, I think, Sal, this is something you were always teaching, is like, skip the difficult question, right? If there's like 17 difficult questions in the logical reasoning section and you don't have the capacity to skip some of those, you're going to have a really low score. So I think that desiring and seeking out challenge and difficulty so that you can prove yourself is something that really distinguishes those tippy-toppy test scorers versus the folks who, you know, are doing really well. You know, they might be in the 80th or 90th percentile, which is really good. You know, you're beating 8 out of 10 of your competitors, but can't quite get over the hump to that like 1% or 0.1% sort of tier.
You mentioned something too that I think is a really important lesson from the LSAT, which is when I talk to people about time management, one of the hardest things for a lot of us to accept, and I've been in this situation myself, is there's never going to be time to do everything on your to-do list. Unless you have a really simple, unless your life is, you've gotten your life to a very simple place, you know, there's never going to be time to do every chore that you want to do. There's never going to be time to do every task, every project. And so we have to make choices and prioritize. Some of the best, you know, time management tools that I know of are the ones that maybe force us to stop and think, okay, what's really important? And what do I really want to spend my time doing today? Understanding and acknowledging that there's not time to do everything. And so, I mean, you can tell me how often this comes into play in your LSAT strategy. But for me, if I run into a question and I start reading and it's really convoluted and confusing, and it's like question number 15, and there are 10 more questions to go, I will happily skip that question, take a wild guess, and move on to the next one, because every question is only worth 1 point. And the 4 minutes that I might spend trying to answer that convoluted question means I'm going to run out of time to answer easier questions. So, you know, and that's something I find people struggle with. The idea that not only is it okay to skip a question, but it's actually part of an effective strategy. I don't know if you feel the same way.
I feel exactly the same way. I think this is a point that Oliver Berkman makes a bunch. And I've also really been enjoying a book called Make Time by Jake Knapp and Zertursky. Well, you can fix that later. We actually know what the name is. But one of the ideas that I learned from both of those books is that if you're constantly trying to like check things off your to-do list, you're constantly going to do the easy stuff. You're constantly going to do the low-hanging fruit, the thing that feels comfortable, the thing that is really easy for you to do. You're not going to do the hard stuff, which is probably the important stuff, right? Like the thing that you have a lot of emotions and investment tied up in, that's probably going to feel harder to do if it's really important to you. So there's almost this inverse relationship between the ease of doing something and the importance that it probably actually has, because unlike the LSAT, in real life, not every task is worth 1 point. And there are lots of different strategies you can do, but one that really has stood out for me recently has been picking like a daily highlight. That's an idea from Make Time. And that's the most important. That's the thing that for me, if I do that thing today, then I had a good day. And having that real laser focus on that, this is the most important thing for me to do today, allows me to make sure that I make time for that. And then at the end of the day, I did that thing. I can feel good about my day, no matter how many other little things I checked off my to-do list. So that's one thing that's really been working for me recently. And the other thing I think is related to your point about being willing to skip questions is every week in my to-do list system, I have a task that's decide not to do some things. Like I need to go through, just because I wrote something down as like, oh, maybe it would be, you know, when I'm making a to-do item in my day, I'm like, you know, going around and I'm like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if I, you know, fix the doorbell. So actually, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, a week later, do I still want to fix the doorbell? I don't know. It's there sitting in my to-do list, not getting done. And maybe there's a reason it's not getting done. Maybe it's not actually important to me. Maybe it's not how I want to spend my time. So deciding to remove things from my to-do list has also been really freeing.
You actually have that listed as a to-do item on your to-do list, is decide to not do certain things?
Yeah, it's like a weekly recurring, it's like my sort of weekly kind of like maintenance task where I like make sure my inbox has been turned into actual projects and decide not to do some things right there on the list.
That is fantastic. I love that. I love that technique. I'm going to share that with a bunch of people if you don't mind. Oh, I guess we're sharing with a bunch of people in this podcast. It's interesting what you were saying about choosing, like, if I get this one thing done today, I'll feel really good about that. Because often when somebody's, you know, if I'll do a tutoring session with someone and we discover something like really important that they want to do differently, like, wow, this is going to make, if you just do this one thing or maybe do these two things differently, that's going to make a big difference for you. And I'll often tell people, you know, the next time you sit down to take a practice test or do a single section, if all you do is tell yourself, I'm going to do those two things no matter what, and just focus on that, like let everything else just kind of happen the way you do it, the way you normally do it, but set those two goals. And that can be really valuable, because if you're always focusing on those one or two things, and these are one or two specific improvements I want to make, if you constantly are making those improvements, then the score kind of just goes tagging along with you, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
And just in your own personal life, I mean, maybe we've covered it already with some of the things we've talked about, but are there some other ideas or techniques or tricks or whatever you want to call them that have really helped you, you know, at the end of the day, be happy with the way you spent your time and what you got done?
Yeah. The highlight has been a real game changer in the last couple months. That's been really useful for helping me do things that I didn't think I could do, you know, things that I've been procrastinating a lot on, making it my highlight for the day. You know, and what's nice about the highlight also is that it changes every day. So some days it's go to the gym. Some days it's, you know, cook dinner with my partner. Today it's prepare for testimony at the legislature. You know, it can be a work thing. It can be a personal growth thing. It can be something fun. That's been really nice. The other thing in my personal life that's been really useful for time management has been having a really trusted to-do list system. I'm a huge fan of the sort of getting things done methodology, David Allen's system. And I've been using some software called OmniFocus, which I really love for my to-do list. And there's a couple of things that I love about OmniFocus, but one of the things that I like most about it is that ability to defer tasks to a specific date in the future so that I can't see them until it's time to do them, right? Until I have the capacity, either the place or the time. That ability to hide tasks that I can't do is so nice for me, because what I find when I have that sort of endlessly growing to-do list is that those tasks start to gain a history. Like I start to practice procrastinating them. They start to get a weight and an inertia and a judgment and a guilt attached to them. And so having a way to hide the things that I can't do, mm-hmm. in addition to what we talked about deciding not to do those things. And OmniFocus has kind of a built-in weekly review to look at your to-do list, which I also really like. So you can be like, you know what, actually, time is limited. Life is finite. I don't want to do that anymore. That's not my priority anymore, has been really freeing. So those things have been really working for me recently.
Yeah, that's the one thing I always tell people is at a minimum, if you like the minimum time management system that you might want to use is to have a to-do list and a today list. Right? Like, here's the to-do list. Here's the big list of all the things I'd like to get done, but here's my today list. This is what I'm focusing on today.
Yeah. And keeping that list pretty short, I think, is also really important. That today list for me needs to be maybe that one highlight, maybe two or three other things.
Yeah, definitely. Again, acknowledging there's not going to be time today to do everything we might want to do today. So keeping it short. And just to make sure I'm clear, the highlight is when you're talking about that one thing that would be really meaningful. Like today will be a great day if I get this done, and making that a priority.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you'll be able to say that was my highlight. And making a decision about that, you know, kind of in the morning for me is really valuable.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I think as you were talking there, also thinking about my to-do lists as either could-do lists or time to just do them lists has been really useful. So my could-do lists are like, well, maybe one day I want to take a woodworking class, you know, and I have this big kind of like might could list of all the things that maybe in the future I might want to do. And then my to-do list or my today list, as you were kind of saying, one thing I try to think about that is I'm just doing it top to bottom. Mm-hmm. What I find really slows me down is when I mix up making decisions about what to do next versus actually doing. So for me, separating out prioritizing as a distinct time and then doing as a distinct time is really important for me in terms of, you know, getting that flow and actually checking things off the to-do list. I'm not deciding, do I want to send this person email? It's on my to-do list. I'm doing it.
Yeah, that makes sense. That you know, simplifying things and cutting down the cognitive load, separating out, making the decisions about what you're going to do versus doing them.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So at the end of these episodes, I always like to ask people a question, and that is, what is your dream right now?
Oh, what is my dream right now? Ooh. Well, my partner and I bought a house here in Anchorage last summer. It's this really cute log cabin. And I have been dreaming about the house a lot. And I think maybe this is related to time, but I've been thinking about how will this house change over the next 5 or 10 or 50 years that we live in it, and how we're going to grow and adapt with this house. Been thinking a lot about this book, How Buildings Learn by Stuart Brand, which is about how time and buildings and people all interact with each other and grow and change and adapt with each other. So that's probably where a lot of my imagination, I've become a homeowner, become a property owner. And a lot of my dreaming is about this environment that I'm not living in and how am I going to change and grow with it.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing that. Well, Graham, it was awesome to have you. Appreciate you sharing all your wisdom. And thank you very much for being here.
Scott, thank you so much for having me. It is so much fun to get to nerd out about the LSAT and productivity. Not everyone wants to hear about this, but hopefully the folks who are excited about this will get a lot of value out of it. Really appreciate the questions.
If you are studying for the LSAT and you're interested in Graham's free guide to the LSAT that he mentioned earlier, that's at lightweightlsat.com. We'll include a link to that site in the show notes. And I'll include information about some of the other resources Graham mentioned, like Oliver Berkman's Imperfectionist newsletter and the book Make Time by Jake Knapp and John Zaratsky. And if you're studying for the LSAT, you can also check out my website, scottmillercoaching.com/LSAT. I'll have some information there that you might find helpful. And if you're not studying for the LSAT, but you found some of these big picture lessons, some of these life lessons that we talked about interesting, check out the rest of my website at scottmillercoaching.com. If you're trying to manage your time in a way that's more satisfying, or maybe you're not studying for the LSAT, but you want to challenge yourself in some other ways, maybe get out of your comfort zone a little bit, I love helping people do that, and I'd love to talk to you about that. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast episode, make sure you subscribe or like or follow or whatever that button says on your podcast player. And come back and join us again. Thanks for listening.